ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Of course, that word there is meant more generally as Gentile, although my Greek wife, I like to quote it that way. We want to welcome you to another edition of Jesus Made Me Kosher. Jesus Made Me Kosher is sponsored by Congregation Shema Yisrael, your friendly neighborhood Messianic synagogue. Rabbi Glenn in with you today. Glad you could join us. We're coming to you live from the spacious and congenial studios of WLQV, Faith Talk 1500. Glad you're with us. And you know, I always like to tell the best part of a story last, you know, save the best for last. I know many of you feel the same way. Yesterday we had Jan Moskowitz, the North American director of Jews for Jesus, and a very good friend on the show. And some of you are already well familiar with Jan. But you know, we got to save the best for last. And so today we are privileged to have Melissa Moskowitz, his better half, with us. And Melissa, welcome to Jesus Made Me Kosher.
That's a great introduction.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
High praise coming from you. Let me tell our listeners a little bit about you. Melissa Moskowitz has been part of Jews for Jesus since 1975. She was born and raised in the Bronx. In fact, Bronx is her camp nickname, because for years she was directing the Jews for Jesus summer camp program, which all of my children have benefited greatly from. And so Bronx is her nickname. And she and her husband, Jan, moved to Brooklyn to open a branch there on behalf of Jews for Jesus back in 2007. But for many years before that, we're directing the work in Chicago. And Melissa, I got to tell you, I'm sure you're well aware that half of Chicagoland Messianic community still grieves that you and Jan aren't there.
Maybe they're not grieving so much anymore. Maybe they're just a little sad.
A little sad, okay.
Maybe just a little sad. I'm grieving.
Now, Jan,
every time I go back, I grieve anew.
You know, doesn't it make you look forward to the day when we are at that greater ingathering in heaven, all the saints from across time and across all our lives, and just imagine the reception line and the catering.
Of course, you had to think about food.
Of course. Well, Melissa, tell us, you know, our audience is not as much familiar with you, so take a couple minutes. Tell us about how Jesus made you kosher, your journey to faith in him.
Okay. Well, as you said, I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City, and when I grew up, which was the early 50s, the very early 50s, the Bronx, or at least the part of it that I lived in, was primarily Jewish and also a very safe and very wonderful place to live. And my parents brought us up as Jewish kids. I have three sisters, and we went to synagogue and Hebrew school, and I had a bat mitzvah when I was 13. Sadly, that was probably the end of my most formal Jewish education. And when I got into college, I was very involved in radical student politics. That was 1969. And in one of my classes, I met a very nice Jewish boy from Long Island. And he was not into radical Jewish politics. He was into Jesus. And I was very much into him, but I was not very much into Jesus. And in fact, I was very upset with him that as a Jewish person, he believed in Jesus, even though I had not really been taught anything derogatory about Jesus. I just knew that we were us and they were them, and I wasn't one of them. And so I didn't understand how these couple of guys that I met, him and another friend of his, could be so good and yet be believing in Jesus. And so I took a semester off from college. This was in the September of 1971, and I decided to do a search to show my friends that their beliefs were wrong, and I was really upset. I was upset enough to take the semester off, and so I did a spiritual search, And I went to church, and I went to congregations, and I read the Bible, and I read all sorts of Christian books. And mostly I was doing that so that I could show them that they were not right to believe in Jesus. And then on New Year's Day in 1972, I received the Lord in my life, because I came to see that he really was the Messiah, and he really is the Messiah, and he's the Messiah for the Jewish people. So though I had been so against their beliefs, they became mine as well.
Wow. You know, that puts you in league with really a number of people that across history, some renowned, across history have sought out to disprove Jesus' messiahship and came to the inescapable conclusion that he really is the Messiah. And so I suppose, Melissa, in a sense, you've got that great cloud of witnesses around you as well.
Yes, and I'm aware of that, and I think that many Jewish people grow up with either misconceptions about Jesus, or they grow up not knowing one thing about him except that their family does not believe in him. And so I think at some point in your life, often happens when you're in college, you say, well, I'm sort of debunking everything my parents believe, so I'll debunk this as well. And you maybe feel a little bit braver to look into Jesus for yourself.
Well,
I think that was the case with me.
Well, that period of time was very much characterized by an idealism among college students. A lot of people were searching. That's really the heart of the Jesus movement. And, you know, in talking with Jan yesterday, we realized there's some commonality with the young folks today who still have an idealism, although I think it's tinged with just a little bit of cynicism as they look at their parents' generation. But nevertheless, this desire to live in community, to really be in relationships, to really cultivate friendships and relationships, and really to search things out. So it sort of feels like from my discussion with you guys that things in a sense are kind of coming back around, as I suppose they're wont to do. There was an idealistic search back in the 70s, and I think there's a new kind of openness among Jewish young people today who are not prepared to just simply accept the hands down, the answer is no, and it's not open for discussion attitude toward Jesus in our own day.
I think that probably is a bit indicative of the times just in general, that people are, it's not so much that people are more open-minded, but the whole concept of, well, if I believe it, it's true. That, you know, truth sort of begins with me. I think that's more of a prevalent truth right now. And so people are not as afraid to look into things, because then they will decide based upon how does it go with their truth. The thing, though, is that God's truth is so challenging.
Mm.
And it can stand alone whether or not we believe in it. And it's also very powerful. So this is a time when people, especially young people, are willing to measure up what God says is true to their own truth.
Mm.
And, you know, you just have to pray that their own truth with a little t, you know, really falls short for them. So I think that people, I don't know if people are more open or people are more open to weighing things against their own sense of what is right. Maybe people are very focused on self-truth now a whole lot more, and that might make them open to considering the gospel.
Well, yeah, we certainly
claims to be true.
Yeah, we certainly hope that that's the case. I can tell you that the night that I came to know Yeshua, somebody was talking to me inside me, and it wasn't me, and that's because I always agree with me. so I knew it was somebody else.
No, exactly. That is just so true. Right. I think that you come to some place where you say, my own truth that's inside of me doesn't really seem to be quite measuring up against this other truth. And so I do think that that can make people more open now.
Yeah, and especially when you realize you have everything to gain and nothing to lose. Now, Melissa, you've been with Jews for Jesus now for 36 years, but there was a dramatic change in the direction of what you were doing with Jews for Jesus in terms of not just a move from Chicago to Brooklyn, New York, but in terms of going from one facet of the ministry to this other facet of ministry. Talk to us a little bit about how this 107-year-old Victorian home in Flatbush, Brooklyn, has become kind of like almost like a little Le Brie in Brooklyn.
Oh, well, it'd be so nice to actually be as intelligent as the Schaeffers, or as committed as them. But I think the similarity is vaguely there, like a shadow of it. I think I can go back as far as 1992, where the direction that I'd had before that in the ministry was, I was very set on being published, and I was being published, and I was editor of our newsletter, and created another publication named Havara, and I really like to have my name in print, and that is very true. I was given opportunities to write, and in 1992, I was going to school in Israel and getting my master's, and we took one summer in Israel to take classes, and I got encephalitis, which is a virus of the brain, and was in a coma and almost died, and when I came out of it, and as I was recuperating, I realized that I could not write. I lost some of my memory. I could not put words on paper correctly. It was a very bad time for me. But I started becoming interested in the weak things of the world because I felt so weak, and I felt that one of the weakest things in this world are children. And I started to become interested in working with children in one of our camp programs on the West Coast, and then gave myself to it. And so the next number of years were spent ministering to children, but then my kids got older, and I put more effort into ministering to the staff that we had at camp, and found that I was the most interested in reaching out to young adults. Now, and Jews for Jesus did not really have ministry to young adults at that time. And I asked David Brickner, the executive director, if I could just work with young adults. And he asked, what will that look like? I said, I actually have no idea, but I figure if I just show up, God will meet me. So David trusted me. And we began cultivating relationships with young people who seemed to want to be with me. And then when we moved here to New York City 5.5 years ago, I found some more young adults, and we bought this big house, and several students live with us, usually two, up to five, but usually two is more comfortable. So I spend most of my time in the ministry at this point developing relationships with young adults for purposes really of discipleship and mentoring and helping them to grow up. And it's a real joy. I mean, it's also an anomaly because I'm 61. I have no idea what I'm doing with them. But we seem to like each other. So that's what's going on right now.
And from what I gather, Friday evening, the Shabbat dinner is an event not to be missed.
Well, the Shabbat at our house, I almost feel like it grew itself. And all we did was provide a place for people at our table. And it wasn't even thought through. It just emerged. Although at one point I said to Jan, if we are going to do this each week, we have to commit to being here, which for us was a huge undertaking because we live such a peripatetic lifestyle. And so we committed to it, and somehow God has enabled us to almost always be here on a Friday night. And people know that, and so, yeah, 25, 30 people show up at our house on Friday nights. Some of them I know, most of them I know, some of them I don't know, but it's gotten around, like the word Shabbat.
Right.
Has gotten around, and so now Shabbat in New York City is a community of young adults, mostly Jewish believers, who want to be together. And they're also together at other times, so it's been a really growing type of a community.
Mm. You know, when you talked about coming out of that trial of going through encephalitis while in Israel, and I do remember at that time, just we had heard about it. Everybody was praying and praying for Jan, too. But as you were describing that, I think that's something, first of all, that I identify with. I think about many friends that you and I have in common who have been through their trials as well and came to understand that there is a certain kind of revelry in knowing that you're weak and pressing into those strong, strong arms. And I was thinking of 1 Corinthians 1:26 and following. If you don't mind, let me just read this. For consider your calling, brothers, that there were not by human standards many wise, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish ones of the world to shame the wise, and the weak ones of the world to shame the strong, and the base things of the world, and the despised. God has chosen the nobodies, that's my rendering of that, the nobodies, that he might nullify the somebodies, so that no human being may boast in the sight of God. So I've always...
That's a very good scripture that describes my situation, because I certainly was reduced almost like to sawdust. I mean, I was in a coma and was not certain that I would come out. And then when I did come out of the coma, I actually realized I had lost a fair amount of my memory and struggled with it for about a year and a half. And even today, still have real short-term memory problems. But I think it's so that God could show force out of the weakness. Mm. And he obviously has, because mostly I just feel weak compared to what really needs to be done.
Sure.
So I think he did need to take me to that place. And in fact, my life verse, well, I have two, but one of them is Psalm 94:17, which is, unless the Lord had been my help, my soul would soon have dwelt in the abode of silence.
Mm.
And somebody came to my hospital room, somebody I didn't know, and, you know, this was when I was in Israel, and brought me a picture of children and rainbow, and that was the verse. And to this day, I don't even really remember who the person was, because I obviously forgot. But that became my verse, that God, if he had not brought me through that time, I wouldn't be here. Yeah, or I wouldn't be able to speak.
Right.
And now I probably have not stopped talking.
Well, Alexandra and I and Lauren and Martha, we've always appreciated you and just how much you invested in our lives. And I think about the weakness, and I think it's a good theme to hold on to, because I think just as soon as we start to think, hey, I'm really talented this way, or I can do this, I can do that, no sooner do we start trusting in our own skills or gifts, and God will sometimes have to take us to the shed and remind us where those came from, and sometimes they have to be taken away from us until it's no longer about us, and we have to be reminded it's all about Yeshua. I know that's been my...
And it's for very specific purposes. It's not so we can come through a time and then say, oh, great, now I'm going skateboarding. I really think that it's very specific when you go through a time of refining. Because I did consider afterwards becoming a hospital chaplain, since I felt very much indebted to the good medical care that I got. And it absolutely did not work out for me to be a hospital chaplain. Mm. The doors were just not open. And so God had something else in mind. And so I think that refining, it's not haphazard. You know, so as again, like, I've never gone skateboarding, so I didn't suddenly learn how to go skateboarding.
You can learn vicariously through my son,
yeah,
Levi.
Actually, I did get on a skateboard once and was on the floor in about 7 seconds. So didn't pursue it.
Well, yeah, sometimes we get this idea in our head of what we're going to do. Hey, Lord, I'm going to do this for you. And sometimes he has to say, I didn't ask you to do that.
Right. But he may have asked somebody else to do it. And that's, you know, what's important is more and more I know that we have individual giftings. And a gifting, it has the word gift in it. Now, gifts are phenomenal, and who would not open up a gift? But you might, like, put your gift on a shelf and say, you know, I'm going to open that at the right time when I... But a gift, mostly people open their gifts right away, and then you need to really seek the giver of the gift, know what to do with it, because he doesn't give gifts haphazardly.
Right, right. Well,
that's what I think.
Okay. We have just a couple minutes here. Now, one of the things that's part of your portfolio, as it were, is that you have been one of the leaders of the Masa program in Israel the past couple of years. Is that still the case? You're still working with the Jewish people going to Israel and India?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Next summer, hopefully, will be the fourth summer that I'm able to lead Masa. And when I say hopefully, Masa is a very busy, active, strenuous program where we take young adults, usually about a dozen young adults, to Israel, and we have 6 weeks there of travel and study and discipleship and evangelism and really learning how to live in Israel. They learn Hebrew, and then the team goes on to India afterwards for the purposes of witnessing to the Israeli backpackers who go to India. And I don't go with them to India, but I have so enjoyed the past 3 summers. They're very difficult. They're very long. They're very hot. But it's the joy of my heart to do it. And that's the honest truth. And I don't say that haphazardly. It's very real. I asked to do Masa, and at first David Brickner said, "You think you're up for it? You think you could do it?" And I said, "I don't know, actually. I hope so." So
I like how all of these things.
He didn't mean to, like, be negative, but I did find out just how strenuous it is. Some hikes up mountains at 4:00 in the morning and all sorts of long days, but I guess God will help me to do it as long as he wants me to do it.
All these great things. You come with these ideas to David Brickner. Hey, what do you think about me doing this? Well, what does that look like? I don't know. Hey, I'd like to do this thing.
But it's really my life philosophy, and this is the truth. I start out from the place of saying, if I just show up, God will do this through me, and he will show up. But, you see, often we just don't want to show up.
Right.
We really would just like to be comfortable. So there's something in me that challenges me to show up.
It's field of dreams in reverse. Instead of if you build it, they will come, it's if I show up, he will do the work. He will build it through me.
That's exactly true, because I'm a person who likes to not show up. I like to just be comfortable and hang out and read magazines. But it's a big effort to go to Israel in the summer. It truly is, because I would like to just stay home and plant tomatoes. But I get to come home and eat tomatoes when I come back.
There you go. Well, her name is Melissa Moskowitz, a dear friend and a servant of the Lord, working with Jews for Jesus for now 36-plus years. And, Melissa, we want to thank you so much for taking the time out today and joining us on Jesus Made Me Kosher. I'm really glad that people got to know you a little bit. Well, folks, we want to thank you for tuning in today to Jesus Made Me Kosher. Please join us again tomorrow at the same time. On behalf of Rabbi Lauren Jacobs and me, Rabbi Glenn Harris, and everybody at Shema, Shalom, shalom.
Jesus Made Me Kosher is sponsored by Congregation Shema Yisrael, a community of Messianic Jews and kosher-hearted Gentiles who serve the three-in-one God of Israel. You can find us on the web at shema.com. That's S-H-E-M-A.com. If you'd like more information or have questions, you can also reach us by phone at 248-593-5150. That's 248-593-5150. To hear how Jesus can make you kosher, join us every weekday at 3:30 right here on Faith Talk 1500.